to be found when someone types in a generic term. The path is to have someone care enough about you and what you create that they'll type in your name, that they'll be looking for you, not a generic alternative. Yes, you can find my blog by searching for blog in Google, but I'd rather have you search for Seth instead. SEO is the practice of ranking high in the search results for a generic term. A locksmith or a hotel or a doctor who wins their generic search will earn a huge profit. But everyone else is left to spend money on consultants and trickery to somehow rank higher. The math can't support this pyramid scheme. On the other hand, a smart marketer can build a product or service that's worth searching for. Not the generic term, but to find you, the thing you built, the specific. When you do that, Google's on your side. They actually want you to be found when someone searches for you. Step one is to make a product or service that people care enough to search for specifically. You cannot win in a generic search, but you'll always win if the search is specific enough. And then step two is easy to understand. To be the one they want to find when they go looking. Chapter 16. Price is a story. Pricing is a marketing tool, not simply a way to get money. Eventually, you're going to have to tell people how much you're charging for your services and products. There are two key things to keep in mind about pricing. Marketing changes your pricing. Pricing changes your marketing. Because people form assumptions and associations based on your pricing, and your pricing shapes what people believe about your service, it's important to be clear about how you position yourself. Your price should be aligned with the extremes you claimed as part of your positioning. Are you the kind of person who buys the cheapest wine on the menu? What about the most expensive? Notice that neither question said anything about the wine itself, not about its taste or its value, simply the price. No one drives the cheapest possible car. You hardly ever see a used Yugo going down the street, and few are foolish enough to drive a Bugatti around town. But within those extremes, countless stories are being told, stories we tell ourselves and stories we tell those around us. A Porsche Cayenne has no conceivable utility proportionate to its expense. It's merely a signal, a silver or red painted flag we fly high in our driveway and in the theater of our self-esteem. Of course, the price is more than a signal. It's also the engine for our project's growth, because price determines what we stand for, who we're designing for, and the story we tell. And price creates or eliminates margin. And that margin is the money that's available to spend on our outbound marketing. Consider the baker. If the ingredients and overhead associated with a loaf of bread cost $1.95 a loaf at a reasonable quantity, we can examine three extremes. At a retail price of $2 a loaf, the profit per loaf is a nickel. At a price of $2.50 a loaf, the profit per loaf is 55 cents. That's an 11-fold increase, more than 1,000% more profit per loaf. And at $3 a loaf, we're making more than $1 a loaf, more than 20 times what we made in the first example. The baker who charges $2 a loaf has to sell 21 loaves for every loaf the luxury baker sells at $3. 21 times as many is the difference between a few customers an hour or a line out the door. But, we say, our customers would prefer to pay the lower price. Perhaps, but how do they value the sparkling, clean shop with plenty of well-paid and helpful staff, a new sign in the window, and a local baseball team with new jerseys with your logo on them? How do they value the handsome shopping bag that comes with every loaf, not to mention the free samples of little butter cookies you call punitions? How does it make them feel to tell their friends that they're eating the same bread that's served at the fancy restaurant down the street? Better to apologize for the price once than have to excuse 100 small slights again and again. Price is a signal. Different prices, different people. The Quakers invented the price tag. Before that, it was generally accepted that nothing had a firm price. Everyone haggled. But Macy's and Wanamaker's needed to get big, to build huge stores with low-paid staff. There was no way to train and trust that many people to haggle. And so, they pioneered the Quaker idea at scale. While the price tag was originally conceived because Quakers thought it was immoral to charge different prices to different people, it caught on because industrialists and big organizations liked the efficiency. But, like everything else, the internet changes things. On one hand, you can tell the story that the price is the price. Tesla told the story to luxury car buyers, and they breathed a sigh of relief. But when Uber tried to match pricing to demand, it cost their brand billions in trust. For most organizations, particularly small ones, the hard part isn't the mechanics of charging different amounts. It's the storytelling. I bring this up because it's a powerful way to understand the story of your price and the price of your story. How do you feel when you find out that you got a discount that no one else got? What if you deserved it? How do you feel if other people got that discount and you didn't? What about the scarcity and pricing built into Kickstarter? Does the fear of missing out on a level that's almost full push you to act? Cheap is another way to say scared. Unless you found an extraordinary new way to deliver your service or product, racing to be the cheapest probably means that you're not investing sufficiently in change. When you're the cheapest, you're not promising change. You're promising the same, but cheaper. The race to the bottom is tempting because nothing is easier to sell than cheaper. It requires no new calculations or deep thinking on the part of your customer. It's not cultural or emotional. It's simply cheaper. Low price is the last refuge of a marketer who has run out of generous ideas. And what about free? If marketing is done for and with the consumer, why not make everything free? Two reasons. One, engaging in a transaction is fundamentally different than encountering an apparently worthless, or at least priceless, object that's been freely shared. Scarcity, tension, and enrollment all exist when we must decide to make a purchase, and the marketer sacrifices all of these when a purchase is truly free. Two, without cash flow, you can't invest in your product, your team, or your marketing. But free is worth considering for other reasons, in other situations. Free is not simply a penny less than a penny, a dollar less than a dollar. It's an entirely different category of transaction, because like dividing by zero, it scales to infinity. A free idea is far more likely to spread, and spread quickly, than an idea that's tethered to money. If Facebook cost $3 a month to use, it would have attracted fewer than 1 million users. If it cost money to listen to the hits on the radio, the top 40 would disappear. And yet, we don't know how to make a living if we give everything away. The road out of this paradox is to combine two offerings, married to each other. One, free ideas that spread. Two, expensive expressions of those ideas that are worth paying for. When a chef gives away her recipes, or appears on a podcast, or leads an online seminar, she's giving her ideas away for free. It's easy to find them, engage with them with frequency, and share them. But if you want to eat that pasta served on china on a white tablecloth at her restaurant, it's going to cost you $24. When a song on the radio is free, but the concert ticket costs $84, the artist can be compensated. The china and the ticket are souvenirs of ideas, and souvenirs are supposed to be expensive. There are countless ways for you to share your vision, your ideas, your digital expressions, your ability to connect for free. And each of them builds awareness, permission, and trust, which gives you a platform to sell the thing that's worth paying for. Trust and risk, trust and expense. The rational thing is to believe that we're more likely to acquire trust before we engage in risky transactions. And it's also rational to expect that people are more likely to want more trust before spending a lot of money, a form of risk, or committing time and effort. Many times, though, the opposite is true. The fact that the transaction is risky causes cognitive dissonance to kick in. We invent a feeling of trust precisely because we're spending a lot. I'm a smart person, and the smart thing to do would be to be sure I trust someone before investing my life savings, or my life, so I must trust this person. That's what boot camp is for. The high cost of participation, blood, sweat, and tears, causes us to become aligned with the group. That's why people change at Outward Bound. That's why high-end restaurants and hotels can survive bad reviews. When people are heavily invested, cash or reputation or effort, they often make up a story to justify their commitment, and that story carries trust. Every con man knows this. The irony is that marketers who need to be trusted often don't understand it. Lowering your price doesn't make you more trusted. It does the opposite. Be generous with change and brave with your business. Generosity in terms of free work, constant discounts, and plenty of uncompensated overtime isn't really generous, because you can't sustain it, because soon you'll be breaking the promises you made. On the other hand, showing generosity with your bravery, your empathy, and your respect is generous indeed. What your customers want from you is for you to care enough to change them, to create tension that leads to forward motion, to exert emotional labor that will open them up to what's possible. And if you need to charge a lot to pull that off, it's still a bargain. Case study: no tipping at USHG. For more than a decade, the best reviewed restaurant in the New York Zagat's Guide was the Union Square Cafe. Over the years, the company that operated the cafe added nearly a dozen other highly regarded restaurants around New York and spun off Shake Shack, a billion-dollar company, in the process, as part of the Union Square Hospitality Group, USHG. In 2016, they stunned a lot of observers by eliminating tipping. Instead of accepting tips, USHG raised their prices 20%. They devoted the increased revenue to offering parental leave, fair wages, and the chance to treat their team as professionals. The shift meant that the folks in the back of the house, who actually cook your food, get paid better, and it means the waitstaff have an incentive to work together, to trade shifts, to work the way a doctor, a pilot, or a teacher might, for the work, not the tip. This is great leadership, but it presents a host of marketing problems. How do you communicate the price increase and elimination of tipping to a regular customer, someone who values the perception of a special relationship because he sees himself as an above-average tipper? How to communicate this to a tourist who is comparing menu prices online before making a reservation and doesn't know that having tips included makes the restaurant much cheaper than it appears? How to communicate this to the staff, particularly the highest earning servers who stand to see their wages go down? What's the change being made and who's it for? One of the big insights to take away is that a change like this can't be for everyone. For example, some diners find joy in the status they get by leaving a big tip. They do it with a flourish, and in the scheme of things, for someone who's well off, it's a cheap thrill. USHG can't offer that thrill any longer. It's not for you, sorry. On the other hand, a diner seeking affiliation as a form of status can find the right sort of sincere thank you feels far better than the fear associated with tipping too little or too much. Better still, the diner who has a worldview that revolves around fairness and dignity now has a harder time patronizing other restaurants. Given the choice between a restaurant where the workers are engaged, fairly treated, and working with dignity, or one where the hierarchy undermines all those things, it's easier to become a regular at a restaurant that is proudly aligned with your view of the world. Dining in a restaurant is rarely a solo endeavor. USHG gives hosts a chance to gain status through virtue signaling. They give diners a story they can tell themselves and others. A story about how the small act of choosing a restaurant turns the ratchet on a much larger issue around race, gender, and income disparity. That story isn't for everyone, but for the right people, it transforms the experience. Who's it for? What's it for? And how is status changed? What will I tell the others? Chapter 17. Permission and Remarkability in a Virtuous Cycle. Permission is anticipated, personal, and relevant. More than 20 years ago, in Permission Marketing, I narrated the beginning of a revolution. It's about attention, scarce attention. Marketers had been stealing it, abusing it, and wasting it. Spam was free, so spam some more. Spam, spam, spam. Email spam, sure, but all sorts of spam. Constant efforts to steal our attention and precious time, which we can't get back. There's an alternative, the privilege of delivering anticipated, personal, and relevant messages to people who want to get them. That hardly seems controversial, but it was. It got me thrown out of the Direct Marketing Association. What I saw 25 years ago was that spam didn't scale, that attention was truly precious, and selfish marketers needed to stop stealing something that humans couldn't make any more of. My team and I built a company around this idea. At one point, Yoyodyne was sending, receiving, and processing more email than anyone else on the planet, and we were doing it with the active permission of every person we engaged with. Our open rates were over 70%, and our emails averaged a 33% response rate. That's about 1,000 times the rate of a typical commercial email sent in 2018. Before paying for ads then, long before that, begin with the idea of earning this asset, the privilege of talking to people who would miss you if you were gone. Permission marketing recognizes the new power of the best consumers to ignore marketing. It realizes that treating people with respect is the best way to earn their attention. Pay attention is a key phrase here, because permission marketers understand that when someone chooses to pay attention, they actually are paying you with something valuable. And there's no way they can get their attention back if they change their mind. Attention becomes an important asset, something to be valued, not wasted. Real permission is different from presumed or legalistic permission. Just because you somehow got my email address doesn't mean you have permission to use it. Just because I don't complain doesn't mean you have permission. Just because it's in the fine print of your privacy policy doesn't mean it's permission either. Real permission works like this. If you stop showing up, people are concerned. They ask where you went. Permission is like dating. You don't start by asking for the sale at first impression. You earn the right over time, bit by bit. One of the key drivers of permission marketing, in addition to the scarcity of attention, is the extraordinarily low cost of connecting with people who want to hear from you. Drip by drip, message by message. Each contact is virtually free. RSS and email and other techniques mean you don't have to worry about stamps or network ad buys every time you have something to say. Home delivery is the milkman's revenge. It's the essence of permission. Facebook and other social platforms seem like a shortcut because they make it apparently easy to reach new people. But the trade-off is that you're a sharecropper. It's not your land. You don't have permission to contact people. They do. You don't own an asset. They do. Every publisher, every media company, every author of ideas needs to own a permission asset, the privilege of contacting people without a middleman. Permission doesn't have to be formal, but it must be obvious. My friend has permission to call me if he needs to borrow $5, but the person you meet at a trade show has no such ability to pitch you his entire resume, even though he paid to get in. Subscriptions are an overt act of permission. That's why home delivery newspaper readers are so valuable, and why magazine subscribers are worth more than newsstand readers. In order to get permission, you make a promise. You say, I will do X, Y, and Z. I hope you will give me permission by listening. And then, this is the hard part. That's all you do. You don't assume you can do more. You don't sell the list or rent the list or demand more attention. You can promise a newsletter and talk to me for years. You can promise a daily RSS feed and talk to me every 3 minutes. You can promise a sales pitch every day, the way the internet retailer Woot does. But the promise is the promise until both sides agree to change it. You don't assume that just because you're running for president or coming to the end of the quarter or launching a new product that you have the right to break the deal. You don't. Permission doesn't have to be a one-way broadcast medium. The internet means that you can treat different people differently, and it demands that you figure out how to let your permission base choose what they hear and in what format. If it sounds like you need humility and patience to do permission marketing, that's because you do. That's why so few companies do it properly. The best shortcut in this case is no shortcut at all. How many people would reach out and wonder or complain if you didn't send out that next email blast? That's a metric worth measuring and increasing. Once you earn permission, you can educate. You have enrollment. You can take your time and tell a story. Day by day, drip by drip, you can engage with people. Don't just talk at them. Communicate the information that they want. Shortly after Permission Marketing was published, Danny Levy started an email newsletter called Daily Candy. It was a city-focused email alert for young women looking for local sales, parties, and connections. The asset was so valuable that she ended up selling it for more than $100 million. And every podcaster has an asset like this, a subscriber base that regularly listens to the latest show. And every successful politician has an asset like this, a group of activist voters eager to hear the next riff and share it or take action. Protect it. It's more valuable than the laptops or chairs in your office. If someone walked out the door with those, you'd fire them. Act the same way if someone on your team spams the list just to make a metric go up. Earn your own permission and own it. When we use a social media platform because it has plenty of users built in, we're not really building an asset. Sure, for now you can reach your followers on this platform. But over time, the platform makes money by charging you, not by giving away their work. And so you'll need to boost a post or worry about what happens when the platform tries to increase its stock price. If permission is at the heart of your work, earn it and keep it. Communicate only with those who choose to hear from you. The simplest definition of permission is the people who would miss you if you didn't reach out. You should own that, not rent it. Tuma Bassa and Rap Caviar. In 2015, in a defensive move, Spotify hired music tastemaker Tuma Bassa to compete with Apple's new initiative in DJ-curated playlists. Bassa took over the Rap Caviar playlist, and within months, it had grown to more than 3 million subscribers. Those are listeners who have given permission to Spotify and Bassa to share new music with them. Within 3 years, he had grown the list to 9 million people. He built the most important asset in the music business, bigger than any radio station, more important than any magazine. When Bassa profiles a new artist, she becomes a superstar. That's a money move, Cardi B. Every Friday morning, the playlist is updated, and by the end of the day, the landscape of hit music has changed. Spotify doesn't need to own radio spectrum or magazine. They own a permission asset instead. Permission, attention, and enrollment drive commerce. Showing up with generosity. How do you get permission in the first place? How do you connect with people who want to hear more from you? The worldview of those who care about new things, the neophiliacs, drives them to seek out new voices, new ideas, and new options. There aren't a lot of these folks in your market, but there may be enough of them. When Marvel wants to launch a new superhero franchise, they don't begin with nationwide TV ads. Instead, they go to San Diego Comic-Con. The Comic-Con has permission. Permission from raving fans, neophiliac fans, to break new ideas, to help them find the next big thing. That's the place to launch Deadpool. Not with a pitch, but with generosity. a special coming attraction, an interview with the director, actual news. The movie's not coming out for a year. They're not here to sell tickets. They're here to earn permission, to gain attention over time, to earn the privilege of telling their story to people who want to hear it. Mostly, it's a signal, a way of telling the core of the tribe that attention has been paid, that this is the sort of thing people like us will be talking about next year. It doesn't matter that there's only a tiny percentage of the movie market at Comic-Con. What matters is the quality of their story and the depth of their empathy and generosity. And then, if they've done it right, the word will spread. Transform your project by being remarkable. It's almost impossible to spread your word directly. Too expensive, too slow. To find individuals, interrupt them, and enroll them one by one, it's a daunting task. The alternative is to intentionally create a product or service that people decide is worth talking about. I call this a purple cow. It's worth noting that whether something is remarkable isn't up to you, the creator. You can do your best, but the final decision is up to your user, not you. If they remark on it, then it's remarkable. If they remark on it, the word spreads. If the conversations move your mission forward, then others will engage with your idea, and the process continues. Easier said than done. You must do it with intent, building it deep into the product or service. That means that effective marketers are also in charge of the experience that the customers have. Offensive, juvenile, urgent, selfish is not the same thing as purple. Too often, impatient marketers resort to stunts. Stunts come from a place of selfishness. You do people a service when you make better things and make it easy to talk about them. The best reason someone talks about you is because they're actually talking about themselves. Look how good my taste is. Or perhaps, look how good I am at spotting important ideas. On the other hand, if we're going to criticize you, censure you, talk about how you've crossed the line, we're doing that to send a signal to our friends and neighbors that you're to be shunned, that you're making things worse. We're not impressed by how much money you spent, what lines you crossed, or how important the work is to you. No, we spread the word when it benefits us, our taste, our standing, our desire for novelty and change. Suspending Fight Club rules. Chuck Palahniuk wrote that the first rule of Fight Club is that you don't talk about Fight Club. As soon as the right sort of character, worldview, in the novel heard about Fight Club, that rule was an invitation to talk about Fight Club. And as it grew, so did the conversations. Metcalfe's Law again. Alcoholics Anonymous is a huge organization, and it's hardly anonymous. Built into the practice of an active member is the posture that, when in doubt, we talk about AA, because talking about it is a generous act. It's a shame killer. It's a life raft. It's a fellowship of connection, a chance to do for others what was done for you. Ideas travel horizontally now, from person to person, not from organization to customer. We begin with the smallest possible core and give them something to talk about and reason to do so. What we choose to market is up to us. If the change you seek to make can't be talked about, perhaps you should find a different change worth making. Designing for evangelism. Some members of AA bring tension to non-members. They eagerly and generously approach people with a drinking problem and offer to help. Social pressure made us ill, they may think, and social pressure can make us better. Evangelism is difficult. Bringing tension to a coworker or friend is fraught with risk. It's easier to avoid. The hard work of creating the change you seek begins with designing evangelism into the very fabric of what you're creating. People aren't going to spread the word because it's important to you. They'll only do it because it's important to them, because it furthers their goals, because it permits them to tell a story to themselves that they're proud of. Chapter 18. Trust is as scarce as attention. What's fake? The internet thrives on affiliation. At its core is the magic that comes from peer-to-peer connections. But the forces that prefer dominion instead of affiliation see this as a threat, and they've created waves of distrust around the voices and channels that we built our cultural trust around. In addition, alas, the exposed misbehavior and greed of many of the pillars we count on have also destroyed the benefit of the doubt we'd like to give those who we look to for leadership. The result is a moment in time when more people are connected and fewer are trusted. When science and fact are often thrown into a blender of willful misinterpretation and hurried misunderstanding. We're not supposed to trust spiritual institutions, the mainstream media, politicians, social networks, or even the person down the street. Add to this the cacophony of noise with less signal than ever before, and the prevalence of fakes and ripoffs, and trust is endangered. What's trusted? Who's trusted? Into this vacuum of mistrust, marketers find themselves on one of three paths. Ignored, sneaking around, trusted. If you're ignored, you can't accomplish much because in addition to not earning trust, you haven't earned attention either. If you're sneaking around, pretending to be one thing while acting in a different way, you might be able to steal some attention and earn some faux trust, but it won't last. The third method, trust, is the only one that pays for the investment required. And it's nice that it's also the easiest to live with. A trusted marketer earns enrollment. She can make a promise and keep it, earning more trust. She can tell a story uninterrupted, because with the trust comes attention. That story earns more enrollment, which leads to more promises and then more trust. And perhaps, if the story is well organized and resonates, that leads to word of mouth, to the peer-to-peer conversations that are at the heart of our culture. Benefit of the doubt is not a myth. There's a ton of doubt, and you're likely not getting the benefit of it. It's only when people are actually going where they think you're going, when their identity and status are already on the line, that's when you get the benefit. And then change happens. The trust of action. In a world that scans instead of reads, that gossips instead of researching, it turns out that the best way to earn trust is through action. We remember what you did long after we forget what you said. When we asked for a refund for a defective product, what did you do? When you lost our data, what did you do? When you had to close the plant and our jobs were on the line, what did you do? Marketers spend a lot of time talking and on working on what we're going to say. We need to spend far more time doing. Talking means focusing on holding a press conference for the masses. Not talking means focusing on what you do when no one else is watching, one person at a time, day by day. Famous to the tribe. Fame breeds trust, at least in our culture. Everyone is famous to 1,500 people. Some people are even famous to 3,000. And that's a fascinating new phenomenon. When there are 3,000 or 10,000 or 500,000 people who think you're famous, it changes things. Not simply because they've heard of you, but because people they trust have heard of you as well. If you're a business consultant, a designer, or an inventor, being famous to the right 3,000 people is plenty. The goal isn't to maximize your social media numbers. The goal is to be known to the smallest viable audience. Public relations and publicity. Usually marketers seek publicity. They want clips, write-ups, features, getting the word out. If you hire a public relations firm, it's more likely that you're hiring a publicist. And good publicity is great if you can get it. Why not? But what you probably need more than publicity is public relations. Public relations is the art of telling your story to the right people in the right way. It willingly turns its back on publicity that seeks ink at all costs, as long as they spell my name right, in exchange for the marketer's reliance on building an engine for an idea. The race to be slightly famous is on, and it's being fueled by the social and tribal connections permitted by the internet. We give a lot of faith and credit to the famous, but now there are a lot more of them. Over time, once everyone is famous, that will fade. But right now, the trust and benefit of the doubt we accord the famous is quite valuable. Chapter 19. The Funnel. Trust isn't static. Visualize a funnel, one with a bunch of leaks and holes in it. At the top of the funnel, you pour attention. At the bottom of the funnel, committed, loyal customers come out. Between the top and the bottom, most people leak out. They walk away, trust diminished, or leave due to a mismatch between what you offer and what they believe, a disconnect between what you say and what they hear. Or maybe it's just not a good fit, or they're distracted, or life got in the way. As people work their way through the funnel, from stranger to friend, friend to customer, customer to loyal customer, the status of their trust changes. Perhaps they become more trusting, the result of cognitive dissonance and experience. Or, more likely, they become more distracted, more fearful, more eager to run away, because saying yes is more stressful than simply walking away. You can fix your funnel. 1. You can make sure that the right people are attracted to it. 2. You can make sure that the promise that brought them in aligns with where you hope they will go. 3. You can remove steps so that fewer decisions are required. 4. You can support those you're engaging with, reinforcing their dreams and ameliorating their fears as you go. 5. You can use tension to create forward motion. 6. You can, most of all, hand those who have successfully engaged in the funnel a megaphone, a tool they can use to tell the others. People like us do things like this. Funnel Math, Casey Neistat. Casey regularly gets more than 10 million views for one of his YouTube videos. That's a permission asset. People follow him, and those people are likely to share his work. For a recent project, he sent his viewers, when I saw the video, it had received about 1 million views, to his live stream on Twitch. I clicked on the link and saw it had been seen 18,000 times. So, about 1 in 50 people had clicked over. On the Twitch video, there were hundreds and hundreds of comments. It's difficult to count, but let's call it 1,000. Which means that 1 out of 18 people took the time to post a comment. And of those 1,000 commenters, perhaps 5 will go ahead and take further action, like sign up for whatever Casey's building. 1 million to 18,000 to 1,000 to 5. That's what a funnel looks like. Your mileage may vary. The reason that he's Casey and we're not isn't because he has optimized his funnel. It's because the top of the funnel is regularly and effortlessly filled with people who are enrolled in his journey. Everything gets better once you earn that trust. The sustainable direct marketing funnel. There's a special case here, a funnel that is now sought after by the millions who buy ads from Google and Facebook. In 2017, these two companies took in more than $100 billion, about half of all the money spent on online advertising worldwide. And just about all of those ads were measured, and all of them involved the funnel. Spend $1,000 on online ads that reach 1 million people. Get 20 clicks. That means that each click costs $50. Those clicks go to your website. 1 out of 10 turns into an order, which means that each order costs you $500. If you're fortunate, in this business we're describing, the lifetime value of a customer is more than $500, which means you can turn around and buy more ads to get more customers at the same cost, and do it again and again with all the ads paying for themselves. Magic. Of course, the vast majority of your profit is going straight from you to the place you're buying the ads, which is why those two companies are so extraordinarily successful. They're skimming the profit off the top of just about all of their advertisers. Google might make $100 per sale in profit, where you, the advertiser doing all the work, are making just $10. But you can live with that, because the margin on that next sale is still positive. Since you come out ahead, it's easy to buy more ads. And the funnel ratchets forward. This is the direct marketer's dream. It's advertising that clearly pays for itself. It lets you scale. You can measure what's working, do it again and again, and grow. It's worth noting that very few organizations do this math carefully. They're spending and praying, hoping it all comes out in the wash. But if you're careful and alert, you can begin to understand what putting attention into the top of the funnel costs you. And you can work to improve not only the quality of your leads, but the efficiency of the process. By all means, work to lower the cost of that first click. But if you do it by making a ridiculous promise in the ad you run, it'll backfire. Because once in the funnel, people will stop trusting you, the tension will evaporate, and your yield will plummet. Instead, consider focusing on which steps to shift or eliminate. Explore what happens if people engage in your ideas or your community before you ask them to send you money. Invest in the lifetime value of a customer, building new things for your customers, instead of racing around trying to find new customers for your things. When I started out in marketing, I'd guessed that fewer than 5% of all advertisers measured their results. It was just too difficult to do with TV, radio, and print. Today, I'm guessing the number is closer to 60%, because the numbers are so clearly marked. What's missing is a thoughtful analysis of what those numbers mean. An aside on funnel math. I'm not sure why funnel math flummoxes so many people, but if you take it step by step, you'll see it. The most important thing to figure out is the lifetime value of a customer. Here's a simple example. What's a new loyal customer worth to a supermarket? If all we do is calculate the profit on a single trip to the store, it's only a dollar or two. Supermarkets have very low margins. But what if that person becomes a regular shopper? What if he visits twice a week, buying $100 worth of groceries each time, and does so for the 5 years he lives in the neighborhood? Not unusual in many suburbs. That's $50,000 or more in sales. Even at a 2% profit margin, it means that there's $1,000 in profit from each new customer over time. And what if your supermarket is special? And once someone becomes a shopper, there's a chance that they'll tell friends and neighbors, and one of them will also become a regular shopper. That makes each new customer even more valuable because they become your engine of growth. This means that a supermarket should be eager to sponsor an event for new residents in town because the funnel is so efficient. And it means the supermarket ought to quickly give an apology and a refund to a customer who's upset about a $4 melon not being ripe. It's hardly worth $1,000 in lost sales to have an argument. With technology and services, we can go further. If we look at a service like Slack, an early customer might have had a lifetime value of $50,000 or more. If we count not only what they'd be paying over time, but also the impact on what their coworkers might end up paying, plus the value of growth in shutting out competitors, plus the value of the equity in the company once it was seen as the winner, it's easy to justify that sort of analysis. The first 1,000 customers, if they're the right people, are practically priceless. Okay, so if that's the lifetime value, what does the funnel look like? The cost part of the equation. The simplest way to think about this is with stamps. If a stamped letter costs 50 cents out the door, how many letters do you need to send to get one customer? In the old days of direct mail, that's all we needed to know. If you need to send 1,000 stamped letters to get one order, that means each order costs you $500 because they cost 50 cents each, right? If your lifetime value of a customer is $700, buy as many stamps as you can possibly afford. On the other hand, if the lifetime value of a customer is $400, you have no business buying stamps. You need a better letter or a better business. That simple analysis is why you've heard of L.L. Bean, Land's End, and Victoria's Secret. They bought a lot of stamps. The internet makes this faster, more powerful, and more nuanced. On the internet, you don't buy stamps from the post office. Instead, you buy clicks from Google or Facebook. Those clicks go to a website. That website click goes to another part of the website, or to an email, or to a trial download. And then that leads to the next thing, and on, until you've turned that interest into a paying customer. Every click between the first and the last makes your funnel more expensive. But if you get rid of too many clicks, then no one will trust you enough to buy from you. If your product or service makes things better, the customer will stick with you and you'll generate that lifetime value we spoke of. If you can't see the funnel, don't buy the ads. If you can measure the funnel and it costs too much for you to afford ads, don't buy the ads. Fix the funnel first. The truth about your funnel. It's not going to be a magical fountain of results. I mean, I hope it will, but it's pretty unlikely. While there are plenty of people happy to sell you a miracle, a self-running, passive funnel of income, these magical funnels are rare. That's because the lifetime value of a new customer rarely exceeds the cost of running the ads necessary to get a new customer. People are so distrustful and the web is so cluttered that the ads rarely have enough power to pay for themselves. People see so many ads with so many promises that the cost of engagement has gone through the roof. The truth is that most brands that matter and most organizations that thrive are primed by advertising, but built by good marketing. They grow because users evangelize to their friends. They grow because they are living entities offering ever more value to the communities they serve. They grow because they find tribes that coalesce around the cultural change they're able to produce. The work you put into improving your funnel is effort well spent. But attempts to build a perpetual motion machine of profit almost always end with bitterness because they require you to push too hard and too fast to do anything that lasts. The goal is to prime the pump with ads that are aimed at neophiliacs, people looking to find you. Then, build trust with frequency to gain trial, to generate word of mouth, and to make it pay by building a cohort of people, a network that needs your work to be part of who they are and what they do. It's easy to skip the last part, the stuff that happens after the first click. And if you only do the easy, expensive part, you'll almost certainly be unhappy with the outcome. Life on the long tail. Chris Anderson's breakthrough work on the long tail can be easily understood with the simple graph you can find at seths.blog/graphs. On the left are the hits. There aren't many of them, but they each sell a lot. In fact, number one sells 10 times as many copies as number 10, and 100 times as many as number 100. A hit is magical. On the right are the rest, the long tail, good products of specialized interest. Each by itself doesn't sell many copies, but taken together, the long tail sells as much as the short head. Half of Amazon sales are books that are not in the top 5,000. Half. Half of the music consumed on streaming sites isn't available in stores. Not half the titles, half the volume. Amazon can do great with this strategy since they sell all the available books. Each author, though, is in pain. Selling one or two books a day is no way to make a living. If you're a musician, living on the long tail with your 12 or 24 songs is not going to pay any bills. And almost everyone who publishes to an open marketplace is on the long tail. I've also shared a similar graph showing traffic to websites. If you're at the circle, or worse, to the right of that circle, you can't compete for impact or ad dollars. Because even though Google profits from every website they search, most of the people out on the edges are huffing and puffing. These huge marketplaces, Amazon, Netflix, iTunes, etc., depend on the misguided hopes and dreams of individuals way out on the long tail. Separately, each one struggles. Taken together, it's a good business. The April Fool's Passover, Birthday, Easter shirt. Here's a vivid example of living on the long tail. The other day I saw a t-shirt for sale on Amazon that said, "It's Easter, it's Passover, it's April Fool's, and it's my birthday." That's obviously a special interest item. one that can't possibly support the effort that went into it.